G7 leaders promised to strengthen Ukraine's air defenses amid continued Russian attacks. The European Parliament votes to strip one of its vice presidents, Eva Kaili, of her position over a corruption scandal allegedly linked to Qatar. Strikes called by Britain's largest rail union paralyzed transport network in cold winter days. It's good to have you with us. The top story this hour, the group of seven major economies have promised to keep supporting Ukraine by pumping up more weapons to that country. G7 members said that they will shore up Ukraine's air defenses and continue to help Kyiv meet its urgent requirements for military equipment. The bloc includes Britain and the U.S. that have been the biggest providers of military aid to Kyiv since the beginning of the war with Russia in February. The G7 made a pledge after Ukrainian President Zelensky appealed for more military assistance to counter Russia.
Ukraine needs modern tanks. I ask you to make this defensive weapon to us. It is possible to do it now. Ukraine needs stable supportive artillery with howitzers and rockets in order to prevent escalation from the Russian side. We need more response artillery and long-range rockets. The more effective we are with these weapons, the shorter the Russian aggression will be.
Zelensky also urged the G7 to provide his country with an additional 2 billion cubic meters of natural gas to help the country cope with energy shortages. Ukrainian people are struggling to keep warm during winter and face power cuts amid Russian air raids on critical infrastructure. John Miller joined us a short while ago with his take on the West's military assistance to Kyiv.
NATO countries seem reticent to give Ukraine some of their most advanced weaponry. Why is that? First of all, they're concerned that some of this technology may well fall into the Russians' hands. Of course, there was the famous incident some years ago when the Iranians shot down an American drone and then reverse-engineered it. Drones, of course, very important in this conflict, and the Americans not giving their most advanced drones, which could have a huge effect on the battlefield, to the Ukrainians for this very reason. There's also a fear that of whether the most advanced NATO anti-air defense, for example, would be able to shoot down the most advanced Russian missiles. Russia has some of the most advanced hypersonic missiles in the world. And so there's questions about just how effective even the most advanced NATO air defense would be against Russian missiles. And of course, it's not a good look trying to sell these weapons around the world when on a live conflict zone, you're seeing they're not maybe as successful as you would hope. But at the moment, Ukraine also asking NATO for more long-range missiles. And that would be a major escalation from NATO if they were to do that. If, for example, Ukraine was able to fire a missile at Moscow, I spoke to a Russian government official yesterday who warned that Russia has a huge military capability they haven't used yet.
The Kremlin says that there could be no progress in resolving the Ukraine conflict unless Kyiv recognizes its eastern regions that voted to be part of the Russian Federation. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says that Ukraine needs to take into account new realities on the ground. He was responding to a proposal by the Ukrainian president that Russia begin pulling out troops this Christmas. Volodymyr Zelensky made a comment while addressing G7 nations on Monday and asked the leaders to back the proposal. The Kremlin has rejected the call, saying it was out of the question. In September, Moscow announced the integration of four eastern Ukrainian regions after the people there voted in referendums to join Russia. In the meantime, a Ukrainian minister is saying that the world should reconsider the issue of nuclear safety amid its claims that Russia is targeting Europe's largest nuclear power plant located in Ukraine.
It changed everything. I mean, and I think that that's a very important issue, that all the world should rethink what is nuclear safety now and how we could respond. We just cannot look at this, what is happening, and say, yes, it's bad, or look what is happening. So we need to respond. respond to this. And the respond could be, first, we should do something with the Russians. That's for sure. I mean, because that's, they break everything that was built before.
The minister also warned that Russian missiles with a range of 2,000 kilometers are a threat, as they could reach any nuclear reactor in Europe. Ukraine accuses Russia of targeting the Zaporizhia power plant that has been under the control of Russian forces since March. Kyiv says the site has cut off Ukraine's energy grid several times due to Russian shelling. The Kremlin denies the allegations. It says it's Ukraine that has been committing nuclear terrorism while launching attacks on the plant. The UN nuclear watchdog has also raised the alarm over the safety of the plant. The European Parliament has fired its vice president over a corruption scandal allegedly linked to Qatar. MEPs voted 625-1 to remove Eva Kaili from the post. She is one of six people who were arrested by Belgian police as part of a probe into suspected graft. Belgian authorities say that four detainees have been charged, while two others were released. According to prosecutors, the raids led to the discovery of some €1.5 million in cash. Kaili recently returned from an official visit to Qatar. Prosecutors just said that Qatar is suspected of influencing the decisions of the EU Parliament through paying bribes. Doha has been under pressure from the EU over alleged human rights abuses. It denies the allegations, saying it has been the target of unprecedented smear campaign. Now over to UK. Largest rail union, RMT, says it has called for a two-day strike. It's blaming the government for prompting the industrial action and causing travel commotion.
Well, we're sorry about the disruption. We don't want to have this disruption. We don't want our members on strike and losing their wages. But what they've got to understand, I think, is that the government is provoking this situation. They stopped settlements and proposed settlements coming through. So I hope that the travelling public...
Now, Lynch added the Department of Transport was blocking the movement toward a deal which could end the chaos. Thousands of workers are on strike across the country amid a backlash over economic pressure and the cost of living crisis. Picket lines appeared at major stations with people being advised to travel only if necessary. Strikers demand higher pay that matches soaring inflation and a guarantee of better working conditions. The action is expected to trigger massive transport disruption during the Christmas travel peak. Britain has been witnessing back-to-back strikes over the past months, with nurses and postal workers being among the latest sectors that have staged walkouts recently. Okay, for more on that from London, let's bring in Said Pureza. Said, good to have you with us. So tell us about life in the UK these days. This is the latest strike again, and they are blaming the government simply. And does the government have any plan to deal with all these ranges of strikes on top of the strikes?
Well, the plan, Beirut's, we've heard from the government, was that they are going to be very tough on the unions. Those words from the Prime Minister in Parliament over the past 48 hours or so. And so what they're going to do in terms of preventing further strikes from taking place is anyone's guess. The solution is obvious: to give these strikers, from rail strikers to NHS staff to postal workers, people in the education sector, the pay rise and the working conditions and other demands that they have in order to prevent any of this from going any further. Today's strike is the first in a wave of strike action. There's 48 hours today and tomorrow, and then there will be other rail worker strikes taking place in the coming weeks, as well as in January. That's a promise that the RMT General Secretary, Nick Lynch, has promised that will happen. It came about after negotiations over that pay rise fell through. A few days ago, they are asking for a pay rise that matches inflation, or inflation-busting pay rise. The government is saying, look, that is not unaffordable. These are unprecedented times post-pandemic with a war going on in Ukraine. The government is really unable to meet those demands. The unions are saying, if you can come up with £30 million a day to pay rail companies whom you have indemnified in the case of strikes, then you should be able to come up with the money to pay our workers. And as I said, this is not the first sector, the only sector that will be striking. As of tomorrow, for the first time in their more than 100-year history, the NHS staff will be walking off their jobs, demanding pretty much similar things. On top of it all, is a pay rise to be able to keep their heads above water. This is a time when the UK is experiencing double-digit inflation that is only going to get worse according to predictions. You're looking at food prices going up, rent going up, fuel and energy prices going up, a situation where millions of Britons are having to decide between heating their homes or putting food in their bellies and their stomachs. And that has pushed a lot of people into relying on places such as food banks, thousands of which around the country are struggling themselves also because of the squeeze on the finances of people who used to have disposable income or were able to contribute, donate food and help to these food banks who would in turn pass those donations on to people who are who need them the most. So, such is the situation here in the UK. And I have to say, in terms, despite everything that's happening, public support for the strikers, by and large, is still there. Although you get occasionally people who would tell you that, you know, they would like to see an end to all of this as fast as possible, the two sides coming up with a solution, and people, some people sitting on the fence, but the majority of them, at least the ones we have talked to, would tell you that they are inconvenienced by it all, but they would support people who are out on strike demanding better living standards, a pay rise. The right-wing media here, as heard from McLeish, the general secretary of the RNP, the union representing these strikers, who, by the way, was called by the New York Times as the unlikely national hero in the UK, saying that the right-wing media have been peddling the government's, the Tory and conservative government's propaganda on all of this. And he's been going around doing media rounds, really challenging me on that. I'll give you an example of that. The Evening Standard saying union boss sees red in new route over driverless trains, saying how commuters and tourists today express bewilderment as they were confronted by canceled services on the first day of the strike. But then we heard the union leaders say, look, we're not very happy about this. We apologize to the public for the inconvenience on what this is. Causing them, but what we want is for the government to give us an offer that will meet our demands. It's far, the government hasn't done it, and the question that should be asked, Beirut, is why would they not do it? Probably because they're trying to turn public opinion against the strikers and push them into a situation where they would have to take a deal that the government gives them, regardless of whether or not it meets their demands, Beirut.
Okay. Thank you so much, Saipur Raza in London. Chinese Foreign Ministry says that the situation is stable across the country's disputed border with India following clashes between the two sides last week.
As far as we understand, the current situation on the China-Indian border is generally stable. The two sides have been maintaining open communication on this issue through diplomatic and military channels. We hope that the Indian side and the Chinese side will move in the same direction.
Well, there were skirmishes between Indian and Chinese troops at the Himalayan border on Friday, with both sides reporting injuries. That was the latest flare-up of tensions over the border in the northern Indian state of Arunachal Pradesh. India's defense ministry has accused China of trying to unilaterally alter the status quo of the region, but the Chinese military has blamed Indian troops for illegally crossing the border and obstructing its border forces. The disputed frontier is around 3,500 kilometers in length and poorly demarcated. In summer 2020, deadly clashes erupted in that region, killing 20 Indian troops and at least four Chinese soldiers. In other news, Hamas resistance movement says that Palestinians will never allow Israel to implement its malicious plots for Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque in particular. The head of the Hamas political bureau says the issue of Al-Quds will remain a top priority for the movement and Palestinians everywhere. Ismail Haniyeh was speaking on the occasion of Hamas's 35th anniversary. The top official stressed the movement has a clear and unwavering strategy toward the Palestinian cause in the struggle against Israeli settler and colonial project. He said that Hamas has long been committed to the unity of the Palestinians at home and abroad in the face of the Israeli occupation and its schemes. And he also explained that Hamas has adopted a strategy of establishing balanced ties with all Arab and Muslim nations with a focus on the cause of Palestine. Our correspondent in Gaza, Ashraf Shannon, says that the Hamas movement has become more popular with Palestinians and abroad, despite Israel's attempts to undermine it.
Haniyeh talked about, during his speech, about unity among the Palestinian people and also Hamas' strategy in dealing with Arab and Islamic nations in a balanced way, focusing on the Palestinian issue. Israel imposed a hermetic siege on Gaza, trying to weaken Hamas, and also waged multiple wars and aggressions on the Gaza Strip to try to weaken Hamas and to try to weaken its military wing, the Zain al-Qassam brigades. But year after year, Hamas continues to gain popularity among Palestinians, despite all these attempts by Israel and the West to undermine it.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید. ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, we discussed a very short period of Rajai's presidency, which ended in his martyrdom by MKO terrorists. Today we are going to talk about the simple life of Imam Khomeini, despite being the leader of the Islamic Ummah. Stay tuned, please. Imam Khomeini's simple way of living was not limited to the period of his studies at the seminary and his struggles against the despotic Pahlavi regime. Rather, the Imam and his family lived a very simple life throughout his leadership as the father of the Islamic Revolution and the founder of the Islamic Republic system. He would never allow his family to do anything which would resemble a luxurious life. Although Imam Khomeini was excessively busy with major policies of the Islamic system and the Islamic Ummah, he was never heedless of the family expenses and would always remind family members on extravagance. Once, he even opposed to adding a new lamp to increase the light of the yard. Although the Imam knew his wife well, he would sometimes remind her of observing simplicity. Imam Khomeini was very careful even while performing ritual ablution. In other words, he used to turn off the tap and then turn it on for each part of the ablution. It has been narrated that when he drank water, he would not pour away the additional water and he would put a piece of paper on the glass to drink it later on. As a disciple of Imam Ali's school, Imam Khomeini used to sharpen his pencil and write lines near to each other to avoid extravagance. Once he said, "Many may think that material welfare and having money in banks or owning lands and such things will bring man happiness. This is a mistake that some make. When we evaluate the happiness of human beings, we realize that the happy were those who were in slums. Those who are in palaces are not happy." During the 8-year imposed war and the likely terrorist attacks, the lives of Imam Khomeini and his near ones were at serious risk. Yet the Imam never agreed with taking special measures to safeguard his life and increase his security. As Saddam's army started air raids against Iran cities, Tehran was targeted with missiles. Saddam had even thought of missile attack on Jamaran to kill Imam Khomeini. In those conditions, the Imam was asked to go to a shelter, which he never accepted. He would say, "Do all people have a shelter or are able to go to a shelter at the time of the enemy's air attack?" The Imam's wife, Lady Khadija Saghafi, would always stay with him at the same room, which was mainly made of wood. One day, a cement makeshift shelter was brought to be set up for Imam Khomeini and his family. He asked about the structure, and when he was answered that the structure had been brought for shelter, he told his son, Ahmad Agha, angrily, "Do all people have a shelter so that we too may have one? Ahmad, by God, I don't consider an iota of difference between my life and the life of that guard who is walking in the alley. If they have a shelter, we should have one too. Tell them, take back all this." As it was said, Imam Khomeini would seriously refrain from luxurious life and would prevent others against trappings. His daughter, Ms. Farideh Mustafavi, says, "The rocks of the exterior of Imam's house were incomplete. I told him to let us fill the empty part. He said, 'There is a rock in the interior.' I told him that they are gilim and are not good for the exterior. He said, 'Is this the house of a chancellor?' It is also famous that when the Imam was asked to let the eroded bricks of the steps be changed, he simply said, 'Tell the mason to turn over the eroded bricks and put them in their place.'" Imam Khomeini had also been asked to let the plaster of the room be renewed, which he reacted and said, "You are building a palace for me. I am not a palace dweller. Do not do this. If you want to decorate here, stop it till I am alive." Dear listeners, these were few examples of the simple life of a man who overthrew the despotic Pahlavi regime and brought the global arrogance symbolized by the US to its knees.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Today we listen to the speech of Hujjatul Islam Salim Yusuf Ali.
We began this topic, we're discussing how is it that we can take a practical lesson from the life of Fatima al-Islam, and we took the example of one of the last pieces of advice that Rasulullah gives to the Ummah before he leaves this world. In that sermon, he addresses Fatima alayhi salam and he says, "O Fatima, i'amali, fa inni laysa min Allah, la amliku min Allahi shay'an." He says to Fatima that, "O Fatima, you should act because I do not own anything from Allah." And we explained how that this command to act was something that Fatima was already doing. In a way, this was the model of her life, which is to have that knowledge and to act upon that knowledge. And we said that in the words of the Ahlul Bayt, in the teachings of the Quran, one of the life practices, one of the secrets to success is bridging this gap between what we need to know and what we do know, and what we do know and what we act upon. I want to pick up from there, and I want to quote a line from one of the beautiful du'as that's narrated from Fatima alayhi salam. There's a du'a which is known as du'a makarim al-akhlaq, which we all know of, that's reported from Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, our fourth imam. There is a lesser known du'a which is also sometimes known as du'a makarim al-akhlaq, reported from Sayyida al-Zahra alayhi salam. In that du'a, she says the following. It's a very beautiful du'a. It's a short but powerful du'a. Allahumma وجهني للخير ويسرني له وأعني عليه وجعلني من أهله وارزقني حسن الأدب فيما توجهت إليك فيه. So beautiful. In this line, Fatima is making a dua. What is the axis upon which her dua revolves? It's this concept of amal. O Allah, point me in the direction so that I can do what is right and what is good. Lil khair. O Allah, make that be something which is easy for me. O Allah, help me to perform that. O Allah, make me among the people who do the acts of goodness. O Allah, grant me rizq. What type of rizq am I looking for you? O Allah, grant me rizq so that I can have the perfect actions, the most excellent and beautiful actions, when in everything that I turn to you with. We said that this is something which is a motto of Fatima alayhi salam's life, and we see that in her dua as well, this concept of amal. Now, last night we talked about how one of the things that prevents us from being able to bridge this gap between what we know and what we act upon is that sometimes we simply don't have the knowledge that we need to have about the things that we need to. And we talked about an example when it came to the entertainment industry last night. Tonight, I want to explore another aspect of it. What is it that prevents us from following this recipe for success? And it's this concept that sometimes the importance of distinguishing between what is khair and what is shar, what is goodness and what is evil, that's not something which is we're firm enough on. Or rather, maybe we've been weakened in this respect. Our gauge of what is right and what is wrong, what is good and evil, it has been weakened because of the forces around us. But when we look at the teachings of the Quran and the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, there is a great emphasis on this concept of knowing what is truth and what is false, knowing what is right and what is wrong, and putting that into action. One of the beautiful munajat of Imam As-Sajjad alayhi as-salam, he says that, Ya muna qulub al-mushtaqin wa ya ghayat al-muhibbin as'aluka hubbaka wa hubba man yuhibbuk. O Allah, I ask you for your love. What does it mean to love Allah? Loving Allah has a practical manifestation. What is it? It's in وَحُبَّ مَنْ يُحِبُّكَ. It's that I love the people who love you. وَحُبَّ كُلِّ عَمَلٍ يُصِلُنِي إِلَىٰ قُرْبَكَ. Oh Allah, I want to love every action that is a cause for me to become closer and closer to you. This is one of the teachings that we have in our faith, that from the earliest of ages, that we should be emphasizing this concept of khair and shar, of good and bad, of truth and falsehood. In a riwayah, in a hadith reported from Imam Ali, he says, "Man lam ya'arif al khair min al shar." If somebody cannot distinguish, doesn't have this awareness between khair and shar, if this is not a big deal for them, of distinguishing between good and bad, then what is the result of that? فَهُوَ مِنَ الْبَهَائِمِ. That person is like the beasts, like the animals. That's what distinguishes a human being from animals, is this concept, a deep attachment to this, a deep knowledge about it, a deep passion about it, about what is right and what is wrong, what is good and what is evil. In one of the really amazing stories that we have of one of the companions of our sixth Imam alayhi salam, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, his name was Abdullah ibn Abi Ya'afur. Abdullah was a special companion, a person of knowledge, a scholar, a narrator of hadith, a man of purity, a man of who was trying to develop himself. He would go to the Imam alayhi salam and he would ask his questions. And one time, he goes to the Imam and he tells him that, here I am, I'm asking these questions. You're sharpening my intellect. You're teaching me how to think about things. You're making me a person of knowledge. But I want to say something when it comes to my faith, O Imam. What is that thing that Abdullah wants to say? He says that I want you to know that if you take a pomegranate and you split that pomegranate in half and you tell me that this side of it is halal for me to eat and that side is haram for me to eat, then I will accept that from you unquestioningly. Meaning that's something that for me, I'm going to accept it. Why? because he knows about this concept of truth and falsehood, of right and wrong, and he knows where he gets it from as well too. He gets it from the people of truth and falsehood. And then the Imam alayhi salam, when he hears that from him, he says twice, may Allah have mercy on you, may Allah have mercy on you. This is a sign of a true follower of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. This is something that's important to them. Now, why am I emphasizing this? Because brothers and sisters, we need to understand our context. We need to understand what are those forces that are preventing us from this path of success that the Ahlul Bayt have shown us. When you talk about knowing truth and falsehood and right and wrong, the assumption there, the underlying assumption is that there is a notion, an absolute notion that this is where you get truth and falsehood from. And this is where you find right, and this is where you find wrong. But in the society that we live in, there is a chain of thought which works exactly against this. And it's termed, the term for this is called postmodernism. Postmodernism is a type of thinking which became popular in the last, say, 30, 40 years. And it's pretty much prevalent right now. If you go into the circles of academia, you know, this is the way that they approach things. And if we want to say what is postmodernism, actually, you can't really say what it is, but what you can say is what is it not. Because what they do is they approach everything and they approach it from the perspective of casting doubt on it. What can I find wrong in everything that everyone else holds to be true and dear to them? Why? Because truth and what's right and what's wrong is nothing, according to their perspective, is nothing but the construction of human imagination. They have this concept of a meta-narrative, which is basically, in simple terms, like a big story. Everything that anyone has ever said about that this is the way things are, this is the usul ad-din, this is like the principles of how you should think about things, how you should approach truth, all of that is nothing but a grand story and a myth and a fable, which is subject to criticism, which we can attack, which we can say that, okay, well, you know, I think that this is why you're saying it. It's not really the way it is that. No, we can go and we can analyze it from our own perspective.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Belgian police have made 6 arrests and seized mobile phones, computers and €600,000 in cash in connection with a corruption scandal at the European Parliament. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Euronews has covered this story and gives us more details. 4 people have been charged in connection with an anti-corruption investigation into the European Parliament that has sent shockwaves throughout Brussels. European Parliament Vice President Eva Kaili and 3 others were charged and imprisoned on Sunday, 11th of December in Belgium amid a police probe into alleged corruption linked with Qatar. 6 people have been arrested since Friday, 9th of December, in Brussels after investigators made multiple raids based on suspicions of substantial money payments by the Persian Gulf state of Qatar to influence members of the European Parliament, MEPs. Eva Kaili, a Greek socialist MEP and one of 14 vice presidents at the European Legislative Body, was charged with corruption. She has been suspended from her party and sanctioned, being withdrawn from duties such as representing the head of the parliament in the Middle East. The Belgian Federal Prosecutor's Office did not name the country, but a source close to the issue confirmed to Agence France-Presse that it was Qatar, which other media outlets have also reported. This is not an isolated incident, said Transparency International. For several decades, the European Parliament has allowed a culture of impunity to develop and a total absence of independent ethical control. The other 3 individuals who have been charged remain unnamed, but according to an Associated Press report, one of them is an EU lawmaker. A spokesperson for Roberta Metsola, President of the European Parliament, announced on Saturday evening, 10th of December, in the light of the ongoing judicial investigations carried out by the Belgian authorities, President Metsola has decided to suspend with immediate effect all the powers, duties and tasks that have been delegated to Eva Kaili in her capacity as Vice President of the European Parliament. Earlier in the day, she said that EU legislator stands firmly against corruption and that we'll do all we can to assist the course of justice. The allegations come at a sensitive time for Qatar as it hosts the World Cup. The Persian Gulf state has already had to battle against claims around alleged human rights abuses of migrant workers. Any allegation of misconduct on the part of the state of Qatar testifies to serious misinformation, a Qatari government official told Agence France-Presse on Saturday. Hearings of the suspects were ongoing in Brussels over the weekend, according to a spokesperson for the Federal Prosecutor's Office. 2 of the 6 people arrested have been released. Prosecutors said the investigation by Belgian judge Michel Claes is looking into corruption and money laundering within an organized gang. Eva Kaili, formerly a news anchor, was suspended from the Socialists and Democrats in the European Parliament with immediate effect on Friday, 9th of December, according to a statement shared by the group. On Saturday, 10th of December, the Belgian newspaper L'Echo claimed that several bags full of banknotes were disclosed at her Brussels home. Police searched Eva Kaili's house after allegedly finding her father in possession of a large amount of cash in a suitcase. In November, the EU lawmaker went to Qatar, where she welcomed reforms in the Persian Gulf state. Qatar is a leader in terms of labour rights, she said afterwards at the podium of the European Parliament, sparking a fierce backlash from other MEPs. An additional house search of another socialist MEP, Belgian Marc Tarabella, took place on Saturday evening. EU legislator will open on Monday in what promises to be a fiery session. French socialists have lambasted the very serious scandal, with MEP Manon Aubry demanding a debate on the issue and criticising aggressive lobbying by Qatar. British newspaper The Financial Times has also covered the same story. The European Parliament is at the centre of a spreading corruption scandal after Belgian police seized €600,000 in cash and detained two members of the European Parliament as part of an international investigation into claims that Football World Cup host Qatar sought to buy influence. A Belgian judge charged four unnamed people on Sunday with participation in a criminal organisation, money laundering and corruption, following multiple arrests and house searches over the weekend, including the homes of two members of European Parliament and a former MEP's family in Italy. The charges against the members of the European Parliament, MEPs, have already triggered resignations and the suspension of a parliamentary vote on granting Qatari nationals visa-free travel to the European bloc, due next week. Parliamentarians have voiced shock at the arrest of the four people and of the related detention of family members of a former Italian member of European Parliament, who were allegedly offered a holiday worth €100,000 by the Qataris. Campaigners have lambasted the Parliament's culture of immunity. The allegations come as Qatar is at the centre of world attention, with the World Cup semi-finals and the final to be played over the next week. The matches are the culmination of a tournament the Persian Gulf state has long sought, but which has brought unprecedented scrutiny. Belgium's Federal Prosecutor's Office said it suspected that third parties in political and or strategic positions within the European Parliament were paid large sums of money or offered substantial gifts to influence Parliament's decision. Prosecutors had previously said Belgian police investigators suspected a Persian Gulf country of seeking to sway the European Parliament. While Belgian authorities have not named the suspects, Eva Kaili, a vice president of the European Parliament, has been stripped of all her duties in the legislature, as well as her membership in the PASOK political party, the Greek Socialist Party. Eva Kaili, a former television news presenter, defended Qatar's human rights record last month in the European Parliament, hailing the country as a front-runner in labour rights for its decision to scrap a migrant workers' sponsorship system. She alleged that other MEPs were seeking to discriminate against Qatar and accuse everyone that talks to them of engaging in corruption, but still, they take their gas. Eva Kaili did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Italian prosecutors added that Antonio Panzeri, president of a Brussels-based non-governmental organisation and a former member of the European Parliament, had been detained in the Belgian capital, Brussels, while his wife and daughter had been held in Bergamo, Italy, on the basis of a European arrest warrant. Both the Italian women deny the allegations, according to their lawyer. Several former leading European Union officials, including Federica Mogherini, previously the European bloc's foreign policy chief, and France's former Prime Minister, Bernard Cazeneuve, subsequently quit as honorary board members of Antonio Panzeri's non-governmental organization, Fight Impunity.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Role of Erdogan powers policies in recent bitter events in Iran is obvious. This is the part of speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on October 3, 2022, during the joint graduation ceremony for the cadets studying in the academies of the Islamic Republic of Iran's armed forces. This ceremony was held in Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba alayhi salam University of Officer and Police Training. If we look at your presence here, those who have gathered in the Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba University of Officer and Police Training, and also those who are hearing this speech in other universities, your presence and entry into the armed forces is a great asset. Your presence is a great asset, of course, when it is alongside the experience of our veterans and the knowledge of the commanders. Strengthening the armed forces means strengthening the country. The armed forces are one of the strong pillars that strengthen the country. Of course, strengthening the country does not just depend on the armed forces. There are also other strong pillars.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Scientific advancements are a source for the country's progress. The general faith of the people and the penetration of faith into people's hearts is a source of national strength. A government that has been built by the people and relies on the people is a source of national pride for any country. All of these things exist, but the presence of the armed forces and military strength are also important means to strengthen the country's foundation. All these various factors are able to maintain and protect the country from harmful, hostile actions. Of course, this is true for all countries and is not just limited to ours. All countries need these things to preserve their stability, but it is even more imperative in a country like ours, which is faced with aggressive enemies such as the US and other similar countries. Therefore, our defensive power needs to be strengthened. I've always said this, and I will repeat it again. Our defense needs to be strengthened. A part of it needs to be strengthened from outside the armed forces, and a part of it from inside the armed forces. I shall talk about the latter. The officials in the armed forces need to look at new, updated ways to enhance the strength of the armed forces. These include optimizing education and military equipment, which thankfully is something that has been initiated in our armed forces. However, more work needs to be done in this regard today.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.